Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help. You save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Welcome to Vegas World. It's time to party. I'm your most excellent host, JC Vega. Thank you all for tuning in. A lot of fun stuff to talk about this week. Specifically, Ryan Coogler's center. Lost records, Bloom and Rage, tape 2. Doesn't live up to the hype. Did any of the theories that I pontificated and wondered about happen? We'll find all that and more. But before we dive into that, let's talk a little comic book news. Specifically, Rob Liefeld's Youngbloods Deluxe came out April 16th. Well, that sold so well. It sold out on a distributor level that it is getting a second reprint that comes out May 28th. Now, Youngbloods Deluxe is a remastering of his work on Youngblood from 1992. Image Comics and Rob Liefeld have teamed up to release this, as well as some other new Youngblood titles, and it's interesting to me that this sold out, especially now, because Youngblood hasn't been, I don't think anybody really has talked about Youngblood since the 90s. The only time I've ever seen it is when Lin Kara on Atop the Fourth Wall has reviewed some of those old issues, but, you know, and Rob Liefeld, I'm gonna be honest, is not one of my favorite comic book artists. I don't even particularly think he's a very good writer, but, you know, nonetheless, he was part of the big boom in the 90s. He helped found Image Comics, so it's neat and cool that they are working together again to release Youngbloods Deluxe and other Youngbloods titles. I'm curious to see where this all goes, because he talked about other media projects and other projects specifically with Youngblood. So, you know, I don't know, again, it's just, it's interesting, because everyone just kind of makes fun of his artwork, and the fact that that this title's doing so well and that there's more projects on the way is really interesting to me. Very, very interesting. And it's some interesting and fun news for me, because I am a big fan of this franchise. Predator Badlands teaser trailer has come out, and we get a little bit more insight of what we could expect and some fun little Easter eggs in this trailer alone. A lot of people noted that the alien skull from the Aliens of Independence Day was on the wall of the Predator spaceship, possibly teasing a connection to that, or maybe it's just a fun little Easter egg. I mean, after all, the alien skull in Predator 2 was somewhat of a fun Easter egg. I think it's around the same time maybe as the comic books. Maybe it's just more of a nod to that, or that what helped spawn it. I'm not necessarily sure. I should probably know that better, but it's been a while since I've looked at that. But, like, you know, it's in that realm of possibility. But also, Elle Fanning's character seems to be an android from the Weyland-Yutani Corporation. You know, she did the little eye flicker thing we saw in Alien Romulus. So that could be setting up that we could be getting a future Alien versus Predator crossover again. I hope so. I mean, Daniel Trachtenberg did pretty phenomenal with Prey, and it seems like with his luck on that movie that the studios are giving him a little more creative freedom. And obviously, Disney owns Aliens now, that Alien franchise and the Predator franchise, so, like, still under the same umbrella. So that'll be fun. I think it's a cool way to bring it back together, even in a subtle way. You know, not directly have to be AVP, but, like, you know, at least let us all know that it's all still connected in some way. And that's really, really cool. Another break from the norm when it comes to a Predator film. There's going to be a hero Predator, I guess, or a Predator protagonist. I know in the comics and in the novels they call him Yautja, and but you know how many regular moviegoers know that. But anyways, it's gonna be an unproven, unblooded Yautja who's gonna be on its, I guess, one of its first hunts to try to prove itself to its clan. That's gonna be really cool to see that dynamic, and I want to see how they explore, you know, the Predator hierarchy, I guess, or how they interact with different clans. In the comic books and in the novels, they've you know, they tease it and they talk about how they communicate through like clicks and such, or you know, sometimes we get dialogue, obviously in the book or in the comics, even like in word bubbles, but it's all spoken in clicks and stuff. So I'm curious to see how on film they'll translate communication between Predators. They don't really do a whole lot verbally. I mean, I know in AVP when they were around, they, you know, had looks and stuff. You can convey that silently with gestures and whatnot, obviously. But it'll be cool to have to see how further deep into the lore they'll go with it, and how much of the, I guess, extended universe, or how much of the kind of things they established in novels and in comics they'll implement in Badlands. But I am so stoked for it, man. It looks really good. The even the hero Predator, his look, I wasn't necessarily on board with it. I'm gonna say it wasn't like my favorite design. And I get it's a fairly young Predator. It's not gonna be super gigantic like an older Predator. And like, you know, they never really dive into how old those are anyway. But I don't, you know, I've heard other people super nitpick it and say stupid things about it that just doesn't, you know, just necessarily need to be addressed, but it's out there and it's stupid. But for me, yeah, you know, it's not my favorite, but you know, it's I don't necess and I'm not hating it either. It's just it is what it is. But November 7th, I will be there opening night. At least I hope to be there opening night to see that film. That'll be so fun. I can't wait. I can't wait to see how Predator Killers does and how those stories come out. Because again, we've been waiting for Predators to fight samurai or ninjas in feudal Japan. We're gonna get a glimpse of that in Killer of Killers, but Badlands is looking pretty interesting. I can't wait for that. But let's move on to one of the big stories on the show this week: Lost Records, Bloomin' Rage Tape 2. Now, I talked about this on the show a couple of weeks ago. I played the game, the first tape, twice. No, three times, I believe. Just making different choices. And I had a lot of theories and thoughts and anticipation on what we could expect with Tape 2. You know, they set up the Abyss and what it possibly could do. Cat has leukemia. And what was the package that was sent to Bloomin' Rage? And who was it that specifically sent it to them? And what did it all mean? Well, I played it. Played it once when it I played it day one when it Tape 2 came out, and I just went with my gut reaction on things. You know, sometimes I tried to, at least some of the playthroughs, one playthrough I played it trying to get the quote unquote right answers, and other one I just, you know, was like, let's make all the poor decisions possible, shall we? Just for the fun. But, you know, I tried to not think about too much about the ramifications on what the answers were and went with my gut. And boy, oh boy, did that lead to some, well, for me, unsatisfactory outcomes. Because, boy, I didn't think that those responses would warrant that ending, but it happened. And I will say that I kind of was disappointed. In a sense, because I felt with how tape one built up, it was a slow start. You know, you gotta interact with the girls and build that relationship and make it mean something. And then towards the end of it, bam, we get all the wild stuff, the supernatural elements, and what it could lead to. So I figured maybe with tape two, we'd hit the ground running. The first portion of tape two, you know, it starts out pretty dang creepy. You're in this like void-esque, thing. The best way I can describe it is a void, and like there's a bunch of TVs showing memories of what we did in tape one, and you know, you hear voices and all of that. It was really interesting. I was like, all right, what are we doing? And then You know, we kind of went back to a slower pace, to say the least. That was surprised about. I thought we were going to, again, hit the ground running, but no, it was more of a slow start. You get kind of a little more interaction with Dylan, Kat's sister, and how, you know, she's not really as bad as you would think she is. And, you know, she's in an abusive relationship with Corey. She's in an abusive relationship with Corey, and how she's dealing with that, and how she's also dealing with the fact that Kat has cancer. And, you know, depending on how you act with her, you know, you get a, you know, sympathetic reaction. That was good. You know, you got to deal with that. I understand you had to deal with the ramifications of the girls finding out that Kat has leukemia and how that affects the entire group as a whole, how it affects certain characters like Nora and Autumn and like what that entails for them. But, you know, the game, at least Tape 2, we didn't get a whole lot more in-depth on the Abyss and what it is capable of. I mean, I thought maybe we'd get a little bit more, especially with all the Easter eggs and little bits about the miners in the town. Like in 1886, there was a group of miners who disappeared. You know, no one saw them. The guy was in the cabin named Jake, and he seems drawn to the Abyss. And another man who disappeared years ago came back unaged, and they, you know, unexplained. We didn't get any of that. We didn't get further explanation of the Abyss and what is it connected to? Is it connected to an alternate universe or something? We didn't get those answers. So in that regard, I was kind of disappointed. I understand that Don't Nod is looking to make a franchise out of this, and they're probably going to expand on this world a lot more. At least I hope. You know, I guess that all depends on sales of the game, but, you know, for my sanity and sake and my interest in Lost Records, I hope we do get more, and I hope we do at some point further down the line get some more depth on what the Abyss is and how it works. You know, there is a tie at the end of the game that clearly sets up for future stories. I mean, the way that Tape 2 ends for Lost Records, Bloom and Rage, I feel like we need to continue down the Bloom and Rage rabbit hole and continue to follow those characters, because the way you ended that, I mean, it did tell a complete story in a sense. You know, I will give them credit for that. The answer to who sent the package was satisfactory enough for me, if not bittersweet, at least in my second playthrough, because again, I played it just off the cuff, just whatever answer I thought and my gut instinct was to pick, I picked it. And, you know, my first outcome, I was not a big fan of. I hated it. I hated it just for the sake of everything that came before it. And I was like, no, I don't like that. So I redid it and got a more satisfactory ending. And I know that the ultimate ending, or at least the bookend to it all, there's three different outcomes you can get. And the one that I got second time around was very satisfactory for me, and it made the answer to who sent the package and what all that entailed a little more satisfactory, in a sense. I'll say that. Now, the fact that what happens to another character at the end of the game and how there are at least 9 different ways that could go, it's interesting to me. I love, these kind of games, these narrative adventure games, or a narrative, I don't know, every game has a narrative, but like, I guess, choose your own adventure, however you want to phrase it. That this title game, I know there's only a limited number of outcomes you could get, and there's only so much branches you could make in a game to happen, if that makes sense. There's only so many ways you can do that, but I will say that the fact that one of those situations gets 9 different outcomes is pretty damn intriguing to me, and makes me kind of want to go back and try to see if I can get each one at some point. You know, it's a long game overall. I think it's like maybe 20 hours, maybe a little bit more. I mean, not necessarily long compared to some other games, but like to divide time out and to figure out, all right, how am I going to answer? What answer will lead me to this outcome? That's what I'm curious about. And that's going to make me go back and play it even more. And I hope that maybe in the future, not too long from now, there might be a DLC. I know that happens with some games, like RoboCop Rogue City is getting a new DLC called Unfinished Business, where you can play as Alex Murphy before he was RoboCop. That seems interesting. But, you know, at least I hope we get that, or maybe a surprise Lost Records Bloomin' Rage 2 release within, like, I don't know, a year, year and a half, if maybe less. I don't know. I don't know what you're doing back there behind the scenes, but that'd be great. I'm intrigued. I would like to know more about this. You know, I didn't play Life is Strange. I know that's critically acclaimed and that has a big following itself. Maybe.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card. The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Y'all get around to playing that one day, too. But no, overall, though, Lost Records, Bloomin' Rage, Tape 2, it's fine. You know, I enjoyed it in the aspects of the relationships between the girls, Bloomin' Rage, and how they still come together through all that adversity, if or maybe they do, maybe they don't, but how that story ties up and how that got me to continue playing. Even though I was disappointed with we didn't get a whole lot more answers, I still felt satisfied overall with the experience. I just want the next installment to focus a hell of a lot more on the supernatural trippy aspects of the franchise, and I hope we'll get that eventually. Also, I didn't have this on the plan, but since I did play it, I'm gonna talk about it a little bit. RoboCop Rogue City, I played that game. I also went down a RoboCop rabbit hole where I watched the first movie and the second movie and then the third movie just for completionist sake and just to see. I've seen bits and pieces of the original RoboCop through the years. I remember specifically as a child, me and my mom went to one of her church friends' houses one night for something. I forgot exactly what it was, but nonetheless, they were watching RoboCop. And it was towards the end of the movie at the warehouse, and we get to see one of the villain characters dipped in the acid water and that outcome, and I just remember that being stuck in my brain, and I was not ready for that, and I was bewildered on what the hell was going on, because I knew of RoboCop, and I know there was RoboCop action figures in a cartoon show, but I didn't know the full extent of RoboCop at the time, but that image of the dude, you know, disfigured and all that, it was scorched into my brain since I was a small child. But nonetheless, play the game, watch the movies. The game is a hell of a lot of fun. It definitely, the developers took their time with it for sure, and they crafted it exactly how the movies looked. That was impressive to me, and how it did feel like the first movie, and it had the imagery on the second movie, and how well they developed the precinct. And how certain shots in like cutscenes resembled that of the first movie. It was incredible. The attention to detail on that was real. I love how they, again, did the 80s future look with that. I know it's the same studio who did Terminator Resistance, and how they kept that style and aesthetic. That was really cool. The gameplay, you know, at times, it can be a little tedious, you know, especially if you don't have all the upgrades. But it was fun. Like, I did not have an attachment to RoboCop, but after playing the game and then watching the trilogy, the first movie at least, I appreciate a whole hell of a lot. I loved the satire of the corporate, you know, inner workings, and also how advertisement works. That was really cool. And, you know, the action was pretty decent. The drama, the RoboCop in itself is not an action movie, I feel. And I feel a lot of people don't seem to get that, or at least maybe that's how it's presented in the 80s and early 90s. Like, everyone's like, oh, it's this big action throw. No, it's a drama in a sense. It's this dude who's dead, but he's brought back as a robot, and he still has some of his memories from his life, and he's struggling with that, but he's gotta be a cop, brother. I don't know why I made it a wrestler speak, but whatever. I hate when I do that. I'm sorry. I hate when I do that in non-wrestling context. But anyways, nonetheless, I'm rambling on here. That was a lot of fun, though. And it really does neatly tie up RoboCop 1 and 2. You know, they tease 3, and I gotta say, man, I know in 3 it was PG-13, and they were trying to appeal to the younger demographic. I mean, they had a child sidekick, and they dealt with more of it being, you know, upper class corporate versus, you know, lower class homeless people, and it was a war on hobos in a sense, and there was a resistance fighter group to like try to fight this corporation. It was written by Frank Miller, and I know a lot of those ideas in 3 he tried to put in 2, but you know that it got cut, and then even then in 3rd movie it still kind of got cut. And I think it's probably for the best that Frank Miller did not write any more movies after RoboCop 3, because if that and his work after Sin City is any indication of his writing abilities at that point, then my God. But also, it's funny how in that 3rd one, he tried really hard with those like gutter punk greaser dudes with their weird lingo. He did that in The Dark Knight Returns, and like, it didn't necessarily work there. I mean, it's fine on the page, I guess, but when like, it's spoken out loud, it's really, really goofy. But it's just funny how that franchise dipped in quality as it went along. I guess as any franchise does, but like, and with every installment, it misses the satire and that whole joke about it. And even on action, in a sense, like, it misses that point. But Rogue City is a lot of fun. I'm playing it again because I have all pretty much all the upgrades now, so I want to see how that experience changes the game. But no, I even less for the gameplay, because like, you know, I'm super not into video games and stuff. I'm no expert on gaming. I just enjoy story in any medium, no matter what. And if it's a good story, I'm dialed in, and I enjoyed the story, and I love playing in that world, because again, it looks so cool in RoboCop 1 and 2 that like, I just, it's fun to play RoboCop, man. And it's interesting too how like, it also has that like, any answers you give, it kind of changes the outcomes of the game. I don't know what is with me and sitting down and playing those style of games, but I like it. Actually, it's refreshing that you get to, you know, choices and situations you put yourself in will change the outcome of a game and what happens. If anything, I hope that Tyon eventually can get the rights to Blade Runner, because I would love to see what that studio does with that world. Because, you know, if they've nailed the whole 80s future aesthetic, I'm sure they could nail Blade Runner to the T. And speaking of which, Blade Runner was going to get a game developed by Supermassive, and they released some images of that. That looked pretty cool, but it sucks we don't get a game like that. It's also interesting, too, that how Blade Runner has influenced sci-fi as a whole since it's come out, even though it's not necessarily, it wasn't a financially successful movie, but, you know, its influence has permeated throughout science fiction films. Nonetheless, Rogue City, really fun. If you ever get a chance to get around to playing it, play it. I am so stoked for Unfinished Business. I can't wait to play that. Like, that's going to be a lot of fun. So that was really cool. And now, let's all that out of the side. Hang on, let me get a water real quick. Let me get a water break. I'm building up the suspense because I told some friends that I had some thoughts on Sinners, and they wanted to hear it. And I was like, you gotta listen to the show, brother. You ain't getting that for free. Excuse me, I took a sip of water, even though this show is free, but you know what I'm saying, right? Anyway, Sinners, it is the 3rd outing of the writer-actor duo of Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan. They teamed up for Fruitvale Station. That was a critically acclaimed film. They teamed up for Creed. That was a phenomenal box office film and revitalized the Rocky franchise for a new age. They, you know, worked together again in Black Panther and now Sinners. And, you know, I didn't get to see it opening weekend, as you can tell, because I'm talking about it now. But I saw all the hype around it. I saw that it was rated highly on Rotten Tomatoes. As of this recording, it is a 98%. And media outlets, despite the overwhelming success on opening weekend, questioned the validity of that success and how will it fare overall throughout CS Theatrical Run Variety. And then they horrified at the details of Ryan Coogler's contract and how he gets a lot of his money, or all of his money, up front before the studio even is able to recoup their funds that they put into the film. And how could he get such a deal, even though that deal is fairly common and a lot of other directors got it? A lot of people feel that maybe there's a big talking point about it because of his ethnicity. You know, maybe not. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Nonetheless, I've heard it all. I've heard about the hype. I heard how great it was. And I heard a lot of people poo-poo it, saying, oh, it's From Dusk Till Dawn. If I wanted to watch From Dusk Till Dawn, I would go watch From Dusk Till Dawn. Yeah. So, to that point, I say, does it have similarities from Dusk Till Dawn in the sense that there are two criminal brothers as the main protagonists? Yes. Are they in one location for a majority of the film? Yes. However, to me, if you are going to be From Dusk Till Dawn, whether you're ripping off the plot one by one or elements of it, to me, if you're going to be From Dusk Till Dawn, the entire opening act has to have nothing related to what's going to happen at the latter half of the film. And in Ryan Coogler's case, Sinners, you know from the jump, from the opening scene, that something nefarious or supernatural is going to take place. So there's no secret to that as far as the story goes. Sure, advertisements, I think, ruined that plot twist from Dusk Till Dawn. Maybe. I wasn't there. I've seen trailers on YouTube for it. But, you know, nonetheless, for this, you knew ahead of time there was going to be vampires. But as the story structured itself, you also knew ahead of time. So that's no secret there. So not necessarily, you know, From Dusk Till Dawn in that regard. To me, Smoke and Stack, the Smokestack twins, played by Michael B. Jordan, were both distinct in their personalities. Typically, in this sort of thing, when one actor plays two characters, the only thing that changes about them is their costume. They pretty much act the same. However, Michael B. Jordan gives a layered performance for the two of them and gives them both unique and distinct personality traits. One is more methodical in his approach. The other is more direct and straightforward. One's more empathetic. Therefore, he does not have that business mind. One's, hothead. The other one's less quick to anger, but they're both dark in a sense with their personalities. The one tries to save others from going down their path. And their story itself is interesting. They come back to Mississippi after being away for 7 years, working in Chicago, possibly for Capone, maybe against Capone. Maybe they pissed off Capone and they're on the run. You know, depends on what the rumor and hearsay is and what the brothers say and what you believe in that regard. That was fun. You know, love interest, Hailee Steinfeld. I'm about to butcher her name. I don't know why. It's a simple name. Hailee Steinfeld, who played Mary. She's pretty good in this movie. You know what? I'm not going to even go down the line and say, you know, oh, this person's good, this person. They're all good. They all brought their A game. Ryan Coogler is a fantastic director, and he brings the best out of everybody in his films. And I dare to say that this is probably one of Hailee Steinfeld's better performances of her career, one of the top, if I dare say. And, you know, they play a lot around with the fact that, you know, she white passes and that her mother is black, I believe so. This is me reviewing it a couple of hours after the fact, and I've read a lot of things since then. But nonetheless, it's, one of her parents is black and, you know, she's able to pass for white. And there's that conflict she has with Stack because she is a former girlfriend of his. And she believed that he was going to come back for her and he didn't really have any plans to. And how he felt it was better for her to live a life away from him and the life that he leads and being in that world. So identity politics definitely plays a lot into this film. And in an interview I saw before recording this, that kind of slightly came up in a sense where the interviewer asked him, hey, are these vampires Marxists in a sense? And simply Ryan Coogler responded with, I'm from Oakland. So if you want to know about the politics in this film, that pretty much sums it up. And if you don't know what that means, then maybe, you know, I encourage you to do some research into that, if you will, if you feel so inclined to. But nonetheless, again, identity politics and hierarchy and dynamics of that. Because again, this movie takes place during Jim Crow era, and they come from Chicago where there's, you know, more freemen, as they say, and it's a lot less racial tension as it is in Mississippi, though one brother denies that. But that plays a lot of it. Remick, the lead villain in the film, one of the vampires, the lead vampire in the film, is Irish. You know, and that we can talk about, you know, how Ireland was taken over and all that sort of stuff and how that plays into this character's politics and ideology. And how, you know, he doesn't want to see color. He wants to bring everybody together under one people. Vampire people, but nonetheless, that's his mission. And another interesting thing, though, about the film to me is, well, at least as an advertisement, the advertisement made it seem like Hailee Steinfeld was going to be almost like a secondary antagonist and how she was going to play this big role. And she does play a role in the film, yes, but it was overstated in the trailer. And I get they're, you know, trying to create intrigue and she's a top name within the industry, but her role in it is very low key in a sense. Still important, but not as prominent or as it didn't lead to her being fully like a second cohort to the main villain in the film. And even then, like, you strip away the vampire story in this, it's still a strong story about how it's black people living in Jim Crow South and the Ku Klux Klan is kind of large and in charge in Mississippi and how they don't take too kindly to black folk with money running their own business. So either way, they were going to have problems within, you know, that space. But it's an interesting added wrinkle, the fact that now they got to deal with vampires. Overall, you know, I will say that one scene in particular, you know, with the character Sammy Moore, how blues plays an integral part of the story and one of the elements of the lore in this world, and how a character or a musician can be so in tune and, you know, his music will resonate from the soul that it will transcend time. And in one particular moment in the film, when the character starts playing for the juke joint, you start to see figures from the past and the future. And that was really interesting. That tells a mini story in itself to me, like the history of music and how a lot of it spawned from blues and jazz, and how that genre, blues, shaped the musical landscape as we know it today. That was pretty neat in itself. That's a bit of meta, if you will. That was really cool. The cinematography in that scene is wonderful, and how the tracking follows, you know, one character through the juke joint, and how characters or entities, you know, like a rock star, a DJ, a breakdancer, are all like scattered around in the bar. It was really cool. That shot in itself was really cool. You know, Ryan Coogler definitely has honed his craft, and this is probably one of his best work to date, and I hope we get to see more stuff like this in the future. My only pet peeve in all of this is the fact that there's so much story in the bigger world in this story, you can mine. Like, the Choctaws had a brief appearance, and you think you're going to see something wild in later on. They're not really there, but their part in all of this was very interesting. They could spin off a movie and tell a story, or a TV show, or you can go back and tell the story of the Smokestack Brothers in Chicago, or in World War II, and how one was a soldier, and, you know, their bond. You can go and tell that story. Hell, you could even take the hoodoo aspect of this story and spin off a miniseries or another movie centered around that. Like, there's so much you could mine from this. And Ryan Coogler said before, this is a full course meal film. You know, you get everything you need. This is, it's a self-contained story in a sense. He's done franchise film work before, and this is a story that stands on its own. That, I say, shame on you, sir. We need more in this world. I want more from this world, and I hope we do see novels and books, because I will pick every single one of them up. And I, you know, maybe somebody could coax him into making a sequel, or maybe he'll get inspired one day to make a sequel, whether on the Choctaw or maybe even Stack and Mary or whoever, whatever, you know, there's so much you can mine out of this. That's so rich. And like, to me, this story in a sense feels like Cloverfield, where there is a big overarching story that's just not present within the film that you're watching. And that there's more layers to it. That was unique in itself. And I like that aspect of it. I like how, you know, it allows your imagination to run wild. I'm like, well, you know, who turned Remick? And how did that go? And what spawned from that? And what could his actions have caused ramifications elsewhere with other people, in a sense, with more vampires? Like, there's so much you could play around with this in this world that was fresh and unique. And, you know, if it is the one ride we get, then it was tremendous. And on the Dubetny scale, this is The Athlete being the Oscar award winning movie, River of Blood being the not so great film that he did, and that's bad. So that's one of the rankings. There's three different categories. I'm going to have to refresh my memory on this middle option because I forgot about it. And I'm sure Caden Green will remind me later and we'll bring it up next time. But nonetheless, back to this review. I'm scatterbrained right now, guys. I'm sorry. But no, man, this is a quality film. I think this movie will put Ryan Coogler in the upper echelons of directors in the modern day, if not as well as put him in the category of legendary filmmakers with a Scorsese and a Ridley Scott and what have you. That might be a bold assumption to some people, but I'm doubling down. I'm standing firm on that he will be regarded as one of the top filmmakers ever to do it. You know, this movie alone proves it. This movie is my favorite movie of the year. Probably also it's going to weasel its way. I say weasel away, it's a bad thing, but it's going to make its way into my top 10. If I were to make a top 10 movies of all time that I enjoyed, this might make its way on there. Like, this movie was phenomenal. There's so many layers to it. Just like how it dealt with real world aspects and then fuse that with the vampires in this story, or just the characters in this story. Like, again, everything was well crafted as a storytelling perspective. You know, Ryan Coogler, I think for the most part, if I recall correctly, he's mostly had co-writers on a lot of his stuff. He's written stuff, but he's been a co-writer. This is, I think, his sole vision as a writer and director, and It is phenomenal. I can't say more good things about it. I don't want to spoil the plot because I want you to see it for yourselves and enjoy it. But yeah, it's definitely on my top 10 list of the year, if not of all time. I'll say that from the jump. Mark my words, he will go down as one of the greatest directors of all time. I'll say it again. That's my thoughts on that. The Dubetny scale, that's The Athlete. So I think I've said all I needed to say on Sinners, as well as For the Week. The next time you hear me will be alongside Caden Green, the second half of the Dubetny Five. Two-thirds of the Dubetny Five. We will also be joined by fellow Funeral Party member Chelsea Durden. That'll be a lot of fun, and I hope you join us for that. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you want to support me, the show, and my wrestling adventures, go to ProWrestlingTees.com, search JC Vega, and buy your own Vegas World t-shirt. There's also, you know, a JC Vega shirt. One says Punk Rock, the other says Rainbow Dash. You be the judge on what means what and what to buy. Buy them all, for all I care. Actually, you should buy them all. It would be great for your wardrobe. It's really great. They're all different. Why not? Support your boy. You can also find The Vegas World at Vegas World Pod on Instagram and Twitter. You can find me at The JC Vega on all social media platforms. You can email the show at VegasWorldPodcast@gmail.com. Send us your question, compliments, and or insults that won't be read, but, you know, they'll be regarded, I guess, for 5 seconds and then thrown away. Do what you will, but be nice, actually. I want you to be, you should be nice. We should all make the world nicer. I know that I come off as a loudmouth, arrogant jerk sometimes in the wrestling world, but let's be nice to each other. Or you can leave comments and questions on the Spotify of this episode, the comment section, as well as the Instagram. Do it all. Follow us. Follow me. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Good night and party on.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.